So thanks to Rob and Luis for asking me to do this joint thing, and hopefully everyone learns something. I think some parts will be more basic for some people, but hopefully at least some new data that'll come in. So yeah, I'll talk about CFTs at finite temperature, mainly using OPEs, but the gravity will come in at the end when we'll discuss some sort of simple holography to describe the correlation functions. So before we get to the physics, let me just thank my collaborators. So this is work with Subir Sachdev, who's at Harvard and also PI, Eric Sorensen at McMaster, and Amy Katz at Boston U. And this paper just came out Tuesday, I think, this week. So it's fairly fresh work. If you have any comments to improve that, feel free to. So yeah, you can ask questions at any point. It's very informal. So the goal would be to talk about the real-time dynamics of these strongly coupled quantum fluids. And so these are not fluids which have quasiparticles. And by quasiparticles, I mean excitations which are infinitely long-lived. So if you take a Fermi liquid, at the Fermi surface, you have these excitations which live forever. And if you have that, you can just use essentially a Boltzmann approach that describes the distribution function of these quasiparticles to understand the dynamics of the system. So what do you do if you don't have these quasiparticles? Well, this will be what I'll talk about, but examples of systems that are in this strongly coupled fluid regime are often quantum critical, so at a phase transition. And one example is a metal plus a gapless boson, and the gapless boson can come from some order parameter that becomes critical at a phase transition. And that's a very hard problem because the manifold of gapless states is extended. You have a Fermi surface. And we have people in the room that are experts on this, so Sensik and Max. And I won't talk about this first case. It's hard to describe, but I'll focus on the other very wide appearing family of critical points, which are CFTs. So it turns out that most critical points are actually conformal as well. So some examples are not, but they're often trivial, so non-interacting. And we have very few examples of critical points which are interacting and not CFTs. So it's a fairly widespread beast. So this is the plan. So I'll talk about just very briefly what's a CFT and why it's relevant. Then we'll switch to dynamics of these things. I'll first talk about the short time physics, and this comes from the OPE, so the operator product expansion. And then we'll try to integrate that information to long times, and that's very hard. And one way to get a glimpse is to perhaps use holography. Also, get back to OPEs before concluding, and I'll sort of prove these sum rules on the CFT side for the two-point functions. And then I'll give some outlook for future questions, which actually are numerous. So CFT is a scaling invariant and Lorentz invariant quantum field theory. So often these two things together imply conformal invariants, not always, but almost always. And these are essentially the best characterized quantum fluids which don't have quasiparticles. So CFTs don't have quasiparticles, they have these branch cuts. And these branch cuts can be seen as an infinite number of poles. Poles are quasiparticles. So you have a continuum of excitations in these theories. And so they're understood to some extent. In 1 plus 1, indeed, they're almost fully understood. In higher dimensions, it's not the case. Where many open questions remain, for example, dynamics. What happens in real time as you probe these quantum fluids? And why do we care? That's a good question. So there are experiments, so actually condensed matter, decent, reasonable experiments, and I'll have a slide about this soon. And many realistic models, so lattice models, spin models, for example, realize quantum phase transitions, which are described as CFT at low energy. And you can do numerics on these models, and there'll be some of that in this talk for one simple CFT, but there are many other models. So you can sort of test your predictions. And gravity is a CFT, or so we think. This is the famous ADS CFT duality, which I'll be using at the end. So there's many reasons to care about CFTs. All right, a simple example of a CFT that arises in a condensed matter context. So bosons in a plane, they hop on a square lattice like this. There's a hopping term P, and there's a term that prevents these guys from sitting on the same site. There's a repulsion U, which is positive. When U is very large, everyone wants to sit on their own site. So imagine we have a density of one boson per site. So at very large U, there's only one boson per site. No one wants to hop. It's an insulator. When U is very small, the repulsion is no longer strong, and things want to be together. They're bosons, and you form a superfluid state. And in between, there's a quantum phase transition. You break some symmetry. And it turns out that at that filling of one boson per site, that quantum phase transition is described by a CFT. And the physics of that T equals zero phase transition propagates in this blue fan at finite temperature. We essentially thermally excite this continuous spectrum of excitations in the CFT. So this is called the 3D O2 universality class. That's a dimension, the space-time dimension. That's a symmetry, and it's a universality class. So many systems fall in that category. So lattice models of quantum rotors, XY spins, bosons. It's essentially the simplest CFT can write down with continuous symmetry. So in terms of field theory, very simple to describe, it's the spontaneous symmetry breaking of this O2 order parameter field. And let's, instead of say O2, let's take ON to be more general. And then instead of showing the Phi-4 theory, which we're all familiar with from textbooks, we're going to approach this using this nonlinear sigma model, which has the same physics. But that theory is very simple. You have this kinetic term for the ON order parameter field, this first term. And then there's a constraint that says that this field has to lie in a sphere. So lambda is a Lagrange multiplier field that lives at each space-time point. So when G is very small, this coefficient is big. So you want to prevent this from fluctuating randomly, and the field will order in one direction. So you have a broken symmetry phase. When G is very large, this kinetic term doesn't cost much energy. You can fluctuate around, and you'll disorder the system. So this has the same phase transition I talked about in the previous slide. And that's our good old Wilson-Fisher IR fixed point, which is interacting. And yeah. So this is how you describe this simple CFT. And this is the experiment that maps to that theory. So this is a picture from Emmanuel Bloch's review article on these Bose-Einstein condensates. So what you do is to reproduce this Bose-Hubbard model. I just showed you just take an optical lattice. So you shine lasers in two directions. You make these wells, which form a square lattice. And then you put bosonic atoms in that. And as you change the depth of the well, you can go from an insulating phase to a superfluid phase. And these are interference patterns of these bosons as you release them from the trap. And here nothing happens. There's no quantum coherence at large scales. And here you have these peaks, which represent a macroscopic coherence, so a Bose-Einstein condensation in this lattice. So the other peaks come from the square lattice. And this is the quantum critical phase diagram of this phase transition. And these are actually data points. So on the left-hand side, you have the insulating phase. And these points correspond to the mod gap, the gap in the insulating phase. And on the other side, these correspond to the gap of the amplitude mode, or the Higgs mode. So there's no gauge field, but people still talk about Higgs. It's just the amplitude fluctuations of this order parameter field. And these scales go to zero at the characteristic exponents, as expected for this O2 CFT. So cold atoms offer the prospect of probing the dynamics quite precisely in the future. So, measure what? Measure these things? So they have a protocol of shaking the lattice and then looking at the energy absorption of the system. I mean, it's a sort of a detailed description to get these actual energy scales out of this dynamical protocol they use. But they essentially just shake the lattice and see how stuff responds. I mean, I can tell you in more detail after. Also, obviously, we won't be describing these systems too carefully because we're interested in this point and what happens in this regime. All right, so the best way to probe these CFTs is actually to break the conformal symmetry. That's often the case. You want to break the symmetry you're trying to probe. And so the most basic thing you can do is put the system at a finite temperature. So you introduce a time scale or length scale, which is 1 over t, so h bar is set equal to 1. So this time scale is 1 over t, and now I can imagine probing the system with some frequency-dependent probe. And if the frequency is much greater than this time scale, so if omega is much greater than t, say you pop excitations out of the vacuum, these don't have time to propagate or do anything because that takes a time 1 over t, and the field will just sort of shuffle them around, and you're essentially probing the vacuum physics. At very long times, when you sort of, the field is very, very slow, you create excitations, and these have time to thermalize with the background. So they interact strongly with each other and with the background, and you have like this strongly coupled fluid. And so obviously this problem is much simpler than this problem, because here we're probing the sort of the near vacuum properties, whereas in this case, you see, essentially doing hydrodynamics of the system. So it's hard to derive Navier-Stokes from the quantum field theory. It's a statement. So let's start at short times, obviously. And this is where the OPE, or the operator product expansion, comes in. So let's define the players in a game. So we have a CFT, and you have operators. And these operators can be of two types, primaries or descendants. So imagine you have some scalar primary, phi of x. X is the sort of space-time dimension of the field, and it has dimension delta. So what CFT tells us is that the two-point function is exactly a power law. It's 1 over x to the 2 delta. That's very simple. So primary, I mean that the field that transform homogeneously under conformal transformations. Descendants are derivatives of these primaries, and they transform accordingly. So that's not a lot of information. You want to go beyond that. And so the trick is like, don't pick an average. So let's look at what happens to this two-point function of these operators as they approach each other. So take the limit as phi of x, as x goes to 0, and you have one field at the origin. And take the limit of the other field going also to the origin. So if you look from far apart, you don't see two operators, but you just see one point, the origin. And the claim is that in a quantum field theory, you can express this fusion of these two operators as a sum, usually infinite, over operators which are local at the origin. So this is a generic statement in quantum field theory. However, if you restrict to a CFT, then this is highly constrained. So you constrain these. So for example, in a CFT, the sum would be only over primaries with an appropriate transformation. So it doesn't look exactly like this, but you can only sum over primary fields. But if we keep the same form, what CFT does is that it constrains these coefficients, which depend on the operator, to be power laws. So in a CFT, everything's a power law, pretty much. There's no scale. So this is t equals 0. And this power is very simple. So the units of this guy has to be 1 over x to the 2 delta. So the other guys here are just there to cancel the other units. So you have L powers of x, because this has some tensor structure, Lorentz indices. So this L cancels these guys, and the delta O, so delta O is the operator dimension of this operator O, cancels the dimension of the operator. So it's very simple, and these are numbers which are important. So that's essentially the OPE. What happens is you fuse two operators, you sum over local operators, and in a CFT, that's an infinite sum. So I won't talk about scalars in this case. Well, I'll talk about scalars, but to understand current correlation functions, but everything applies generically to any primary field. So imagine a flavor current, J mu, which is conserved. And for simplicity, we'll look at the connectivity, which is just the zero spatial momentum part of the two-point function of the currents. So that's a Kubo formula, essentially. And you divide 1 over omega to get a response function. So that's the object that we'll be sort of interested in understanding at finite temperature. All right, so this is the key equation, I think, in the presentation, is this OP of two currents in a CFT. And here I've been sloppy with tensor indices. So this is more complex, the tensor structure in here as well. But in the next slide, I'll be more in detail. This is just to give you a flavor of what appears. So I've written down the potentially most important operators in this OPE. And so this is some scalar O, and that's the stress tensor, which appears in every CFT. And these powers, so you want this whole thing to go as 1 over x to the 4. So the current has dimension 2. So that's why this is 2 times 2. And you want to have everything with the same dimension. So that's why this is 1 over x, because t has units of 1 over x cubed. So 1 over x cubed and 1 over x is 1 over x to the 4. So yeah, the scalar has dimension delta, and the stress tensor has dimension 3, which is not normalized because it's a conserved quantity. same for the current. And that term, as I said, is generic. In every CFT, you'll have that term in the OPE. I mean, so this might be zero for some reasons, but generically, it won't be zero. And how do you compute this? So, you know, I wrote this down, but how do I know that this is what's happened? What happens? Well, you compute these three-point functions of, so if you want to know what this coefficient is, for example, you compute the three-point function of two currents and the operator O, the scalar, essentially the overlap of this pair with the scalar operator. And this is what we did for a few CFTs in our paper, although I won't give the details in this talk. So is this equation clear? All right. So let me just Fourier transform, because we're going to look at connectivity, especially in frequency. So here, this bold omega is a tree vector. And omega n is an imaginary frequency. So I put an n index because if the temperature is finite, they're quantized because time is a circle, but you can take the t equals zero limit where it's a continuum. But we're working in imaginary time. That's the emphasis here. So this term comes from the identity operator. So these are the three terms from the previous slide. And this is the scalar term. And here, the stress tensor term, I sort of spelled out the details of the tensor structure here. So there's not only one coefficient that describes it. There's two, actually. There's this gamma that appears here, which we'll see later in the talk. So we want to convert this OP to the connectivity at large frequencies or short times. And to do that, you take the thermal average of this OP. So this OP is obtained at t equals zero, but you can get it. No, it's true at finite temperatures. So you just take an average at finite temperature of both left and right-hand sides. And the rule of the game is that operators, so a primary operator, so say a scalar O, if you take the thermal average, this will be essentially t to the delta, where delta is the dimension of that operator. So t is the only energy scale in the problem, and delta tells you what are the units of that operator pretty much. And b is some universal constant. So take the thermal average of the OP, divide by omega, so the connectivity at imaginary frequencies is minus 1 over omega n, imaginary time of this two-point function. I mean, there might be some contact terms here. I'm not writing it down. And this is what you get. So the first term gives you a constant. You know, omega disappears. This term gives you this 1 over omega to the delta, and this is 1 over omega to the cube. And these are coefficients. So B1 and B2, what are these guys? So I'm going to drop sort of all constants, order 1 constants. So B1 has to have this OP coefficient with a scalar O. And it also has this B number from the average of the operator O. And B2 is the same thing, essentially. So CJJ overlap with a stress tensor. In this case, I define stuff such that there's also a gamma that appears there. So it's this. And if you average the stress tensor, say TXX at fine temperature, you get some constant HXX. And the dimension of the stress tensor is 3 in 2 plus 1 space dimensions. So that's what B1 and B2 are. And so this is what describes the large frequency behavior of the connectivity. And now the question is, what is the dominant operator in the OPE for a generic CFT? In particular, what is the answer for the ON model? So it turns out that for the ON CFT, it's a scalar. And the scalar, so if we look at this sigma model description, the scalar is nothing else but the Lagrange multiplier field, lambda. I mean, sort of vaguely speaking, you can also see that scalar as being phi squared, a singlet. So both phi squared and lambda have the dimension 3 minus 1 over nu, and nu is this correlation length. It tells you how the correlation length grows in a system as you detune from a critical point. So it's a special operator, actually. And so what is nu? So when n is infinite, you can solve that CFT exactly, and you find that nu is equal to 1, so 3 minus 1 is 2. So 2 is less than 3, so this is more important than a stress tensor when n is infinite. Is this also true when n is finite? The answer is yes. So when n is equal to 2, we have amazing estimates from Monte Carlo and also bootstrap methods and even experiments. So nu is roughly 2/3. If you do 1/2, it's 3/2. Subtract 3, you get essentially 3/2. So delta is 1.5. So for n equal 2, the dimension of the scalar operator is half the dimension of the stress tensor. So it's much more important at large frequencies or short times. But all CFTs always have this 1/(omega³) term in principle. I mean, the coefficient can be zero, but in principle, it's not zero because there's always a stress tensor. And in some cases, that's a dominant asymptotic behavior, actually. So for example, if you take a Dirac CFT, so free Dirac fermion, so toy model of graphene, there's no scalar or no other operator that appears that has dimensions below 3. So for example, you can't write down an operator like this, like a scale, like a mass, because so the mass, psi bar psi, actually breaks time reversal and inversion symmetry in 2+1 dimensions. So that term won't appear in the OPE, because the OPE is constrained by symmetry. You can't write down anything you want. And if you couple those Dirac fermions to a gauge field, so couple n flavors of Dirac fermions to one gauge field, you get massless QED3 with n flavors. When n is large enough, you don't have global symmetry breaking, and that's believed to be a CFT in the IR, which is coupled. And the prediction there is that that theory won't have the asymptotic behavior of the connectivity is 1/(omega³). Because again, by symmetry, there's no lower dimension operator. No. Yeah, so just massless Dirac fermions coupled to one gauge field when n is large enough. You don't want to have this chiral symmetry breaking, so that's why you take n to be large enough. And you can do 1/n expansion to study this CFT. So just from the simple consideration, you can constrain the short time physics of these strongly coupled systems.
There's some link, right? N bigger than 8 or
something. Exactly, yeah. And let's check this using Monte Carlo. So this is a simulation that Eric Sorensen did for the O2 CFT, so did this Bose-Hubbard phase transition I talked about. And so this is not the Bose-Hubbard model, but a simplified model that has the same universality class. It's called a VLAN model. Anyways, I mean, this is the connectivity as a function of the imaginary frequency. And you can only probe the positive Matsubara frequencies, so it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And so Eric fitted this to a power law to see what's the power. Is it really this 1/(omega) to the delta? And so the fit, in this case, has the first 6 or 7 points, because the rest have systematic errors. And so, anyways, so if you fit to these points, you find this expression. In particular, you find that, so this goes to a constant, which is the t equals 0 value, but the way you reach that constant is given by this power, which agrees exactly with the OPE analysis. So the power you get is roughly 1.516. So this is exactly what you expect from having the scalar in a JJ OPE. And then Eric finds that there's a small subleading correction due to the stress tensor, so the cube. But you know, it's harder to extract subleading terms. I think one needs better data to sort of make a definitive statement on this. But all right, so this works as expected. So it's a quantum Rotor model that you transform to be essentially equal to the sum over some link variables, which are current. So this is the VLAN model. And these current variables have a constraint that they're divergence-free. Yeah. So it's very efficient to simulate. And it has the same critical point. It's like a quantum rotor simplified version where you replace a cosine by a sum of exponentials. All right, so this is the short time physics, and now the goal is to understand longer time physics. And this picture is supposed to represent something that's inaccessible. It's actually Mont Blanc here. And this winter, there was a lot of snow in the Alps, so you actually could not access Mont Blanc using this Italian phase because there was too many avalanche risks. So we have to face some avalanche risks if you want to go to longer times, because it's a hard question. The numerics don't really help too much, because the numerics give you physics on imaginary frequencies for omega greater than 2 pi t. So omega over t is already 6. That's your first data point. So we need something else, and there's not much else. So we're going to use this cool tool called ADS-CFT to generate a family of physically motivated, so constrained, variational functions, sigma of omega over t, and see how this compares with Eric's data, for example. So this is my one slide on what is holography. So if you haven't seen it, I don't think this will explain this in any detail, but the idea is that you can describe certain CFTs, usually large N-gauge theories. So this is a CFT in 2 plus 1 dimensions. I'm just showing the space part. In terms of gravity in one higher space dimension, there's a compact space that I'm leaving out. And this other dimension in the gravity theory is supposed to describe the RG flow of the CFT. And so based on simple symmetry considerations, you can say that at t equals 0, the space-time should be anti-de Sitter. Essentially layers of Minkowski, which are getting smaller and smaller. If you heat up the system, you break conformal invariance, and you put a scale in the system. So something has to break at some point in a space-time. And a simple way to understand temperature is to put a black hole in this background.
So on the Sigma model, could you also use large N instead of it and get some intuition also from large N? Presumably at large N, you should be able to compute the Sigma.
Yeah. So when n is infinite, you can compute this exactly to my temperature.
Yeah, but then many one over n corrections should not be that hard to compute.
It's quite hard, actually. So, I mean, we did it. I mean, Subir did it, and then we sort of did it also. And so if you look at the results from the large n expansion, so when n is infinite, it's a solvable theory, so you want to approach this by doing one over n expansion. And if you plot the real part of sigma as a function of omega over t, when n is infinite, you have a delta function at t equals 0, then a spectral gap, and you plateau to this asymptotic value, which is given by the ground state. And when n is finite, you can sort of find how this renormalizes at large frequencies. That's a vacuum calculation. And you can sort of broaden this delta function to Lorentzian, literally Lorentzian. And then in between, people have not computed what happens. You have to solve some, for example, if you approach it that way, a quantum Boltzmann equation for the weakly interacting quasiparticles, which interact with a strength 1 over n. And it turns out solving that equation is quite difficult. So we can solve it at large frequencies, it's very simple, but in between, so you can draw some interpolation curve. So yeah, 1 over n is a bit tricky, but maybe if some grad students, you know, feel they have the energy, they should try this. Yeah, Max.
Is there a simple way to understand the delta function and
infinite? Yeah. So that's a good question. So when n is infinite, these quasiparticles don't interact, literally have ballistic modes. So there's no way the current can relax in this theory. You need some interactions to relax the current. And that's what happens at 1 over n. So this height of this Lorentzian is of height 1 over n. Because exactly, so ballistic particles just don't see each other. So the current, you put on a current, it flows forever. And you can also do this using the epsilon expansion near four space-time dimensions. So that's the standard Wilson-Fisher, you get a similar picture. And it's equally hard to compute what happens in between. So even the simple 1 over n is hard to compute dynamics, although it's very simple to compute exponents. So exponents, you get to a very high precision using 1 over n or epsilon expansions. With dynamics, is a different business. All right, so back to, okay, so u is this RG coordinate in this higher dimensional dual gravity description, and it's asymptotically ADS, and it is a black hole. And so we want to understand current two-point functions, so current in a CFT will be dual to a gauge field in the bulk, so a global U1 is dual to a local U1, and this gauge field has this extra coordinate, U. And by solving the equation of motion for this gauge field, So give me some action, the gauge field will evolve, you solve the equation of motion. There's a prescription to compute the two-point function of this current in the CFT. And this is the formula pretty much. So if you know how the gauge field approaches the boundary where the CFT lives, you can extract the response function. So this has the form of a response over applied field type expression. So now the name of the game is to find actions which are reasonable. So people have studied this, and so this is, so Rob and Subir and AJ Singh have looked at this in a lot of detail, and if you do a derivative expansion, so you look at what are the allowed terms for this gauge action, you find that if you include four derivatives, you have, so this is the Maxwell term, F squared, for the bulk gauge field, which is equal to the current, then you have this other term, which couples the gauge field to the curvature. So C is a traceless part of the Riemann tensor, it's a Weyl tensor. And it turns out there's no other terms that will transform the physics if you stick to four derivatives. And the question now is, so if we want to compare this, for example, with the Owen model, let's try to understand what's the short time physics of this theory. And it turns out the asymptotics at large frequencies of this is not surprising, but it's 1 over omega to the cube. And so this is simply seen because in a CFT, so in this theory, in a bulk, you only have the metric G and this gauge field. So the gauge field is the current you're probing, and the stress tensor, T, is dual to the metric in the bulk. So essentially what you're doing by turning on this finite gamma here, this coefficient, you're turning on a finite three-point function between two currents and a stress tensor. So in the gravity side, this is the term which is FF, and T is the Weyl tensor, which is essentially the Riemann tensor, curvature of the metric. So just by doing no calculation, you can essentially immediately conclude that you'll have 1 over omega cubed behavior, and you can confirm this using WKB analysis, which I've done in this paper. But so that's a bad start for the O2 CFT. And so originally we used that holographic model to compare with Eric's data on the O2. And so this is what, so we tried our best to fit the points. So the points are the QMC, that's imaginary frequencies, that's connectivity. And the dots are, you know, what you get when you do your best. So there's no way they can fit the points with that theory, so the gamma. And so we had to rescale that purple curve to get the green curve. So kappa is some rescaling fudge factor, which we included, and that was equal to 0.02. And the reason you had to rescale is that you're trying to fit a 1 over omega to the 1.5 power with a 1 over omega cube power. So there's no way you're going to fit that. We sort of didn't realize that before, but so yeah. So it's kind of cheating, right? You're just rescaling this wrong power. Well, it turns out the conclusions are not dramatically different, but it's the wrong physics. And so let's improve this. And here's a very simple way to improve this. It's not the full answer, but this is a first step. So we have to put the right field content in the bulk to describe this OP. So let's not turn on this, because this we know is not the most important part at large frequencies, but we know that the most important part comes from the scalar, phi squared. And so in a bulk, you put a scalar field phi of x, which is dual to this scalar O on the boundary theory. And this couples like a dilaton to your Maxwell term. So that's F squared, and it's like the gauge coupling is changing as a function of the RG scale. And this will give you the right answer because, so it will match the behavior of this phi to get the right asymptotics for the scalar field of the CFT, which we know what it is because we just computed it. So the simplest ansatz you can write down for the profile, so without solving anything, you just constrain this phi to be fixed to this profile. So U is this RG coordinate that goes from 0 to 1. So so this is 0, this is the UV of the CFT, and 1 is where the black hole is. And what you do is you just postulate this profile, which is a power law. And so we know this has to be true near or equal to 0. That's how you produce the actual OPE. So the near boundary behavior of this T theory gives you the UV physics of the CFT. So that's for sure U to the delta. But then what happens at smaller U near the ball, near the horizon, near the black hole, that's in principle can be different, but let's postulate this profile to be exact at all U. And actually what's interesting is that if you set delta equal to 3, so if we set this delta equal to 3 and alpha equal to 4 gamma, we exactly reproduce the physics of this term that was studied by Rob and company. So exactly. So this ansatz is not very random. There's a point at which it corresponds exactly to sort of a well-studied beast. But here, delta won't be 3, but will be 1.5, the dimension of this phi squared operator. And so this is a fit. So this is, again, Eric's data on the imaginary axis for this O2 CFT. And the black line corresponds to the fit you get from holography by setting delta to 1.5, which is what we know. And the coefficient you're tuning, you're fitting, is alpha, the strength of this dilaton coupling to the gauge field. And in this case, what's nice is that there's no parameters that are fudge factors that we need to include. The fit is essentially perfect without any fudge factors. I mean, you can fit many functions to a set of points, like 10 points or 15 points, but...
you are just checking the OP limit. The other limit is just going to zero. You cannot distinguish how it goes to zero in this plot. Can you? I mean, it's
no,
just
you cannot,
constant.
You cannot.
I mean, you are just seeing the OP, right? Anything that does with OP will look good.
Yeah, pretty much.
So then you are getting what you are putting behind.
But the point is that these functions that you're putting in have sort of sensible physics, even at small frequencies. So, I mean, these functions are constrained by sum rules, for example. I'll come to that soon. But these are not random functions. They're not only power laws at large frequencies. There's a certain set of properties like causality, sum rules, asymptotics that is preserved by these functions. But you're right. I mean, other functions could also fit that. And this essentially tells you about the ill-posed nature of analytic continuation with a measure zero set of points.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
If you go back,
yeah, yeah.
Does it have its own action or it's a background field, phi of x?
So, in principle, in principle, it should have its own action, and you would solve the equation of motion for this phi field in a metric in a consistent fashion. But we didn't. We sort of just put the simplest thing you expect. So, this behavior at small u, this you would get anyways. But to get the smaller u physics, in principle, this can be different and can give rise to different small frequency behavior. Because in principle, the metric also, you know, this can back react on the metric and change the background. And so it's a more complicated business. But it turns out that even if you do like the simplest ansatz, you get sort of reasonable physics. But it's not a unique solution of the gravity. And so this is what happens if you look at real frequencies. So you take this imaginary time data and look at real frequencies, which holography gives you for free. So now this is the real part of sigma, because sigma has real and imaginary parts on the real frequency axis. And this dashed line is what we got before by using this sort of fudged gamma theory. And the green line is what we get with this new fit. So they look different. But you know, there's some qualitative features that are the same. They're both peaked at small frequencies, and this corresponds to a specific pole structure of these functions in lower half plane. Won't talk about this too much. And at really, really small frequencies, at really long times, we know that these things don't capture the right physics, because there you expect that hydrodynamics actually breaks down in 2+1 dimensions. So the connectivity is infinite, generically, for a CFT at fine temperature. And these holographic models don't have this property, because the number of colors of this gauge field is infinite. So you suppress these long time tails. If you want to ask about long time tails, I'll be happy to answer this at the end. But so at very, very small frequencies, this should shoot up in some logarithmic fashion. It's pretty weak divergence, but it comes from 2+1D hydrodynamics. All right, so let's look at another thing that we were interested in, is to constrain these two-point functions somehow without holography. So it turns out that the connectivity satisfies this very simple sum rule. If you take the real part of sigma and subtract this asymptotic value, at infinity, or t equals zero, integrate over all frequencies, you get zero. And this tells you that you have to oscillate about the asymptotic value. It turns out there's a dual S-dual sum rule. So S-duality sends sigma to 1 over sigma. That's also true. So essentially, we replace sigma by 1 over sigma, and the same holds. So this is true generically in these holographic theories. You can prove that. On the CFT side, you can check for all the free theories, I mean, or nearly free theories. So N equal 8 per Yang-Mills has a conductivity which is exactly constant. So both are trivially true in 2 plus 1 dimensions. The ON CFT when n is infinite has a non-trivial profile, which I just shown here, with a delta function and some plateau. This also satisfies it. And a Dirac CFT of free fermions also satisfies it. And actually, these three satisfy the dual sum rule as well. So all the checks you can do satisfy them. And so the question is, can we prove them?
Excuse me? So why is it called S-dual
version? So S-duality is like this particle-vortex duality. So if you perform this on the Bose-Hubbard model, for example, or this O2 CFT, you get a description in terms of vortices.
So this sum, the second sum rule does not come from Hubbard, right?
It doesn't. I mean, I'm saying that. Does not come from Hubbard.
If I remember correctly, for axions, you have a sum rule, which is basically the total spectral weight of the dielectric function is controlled by some operator averaged in vacuum or in with respect or at fan temperature.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, there is also a sum rule for 1 over epsilon, which is also controlled by the operator averaged in some operator or some commutators averaged in vacuum. So I suppose this also can be derived for generic microscopic models.
Yeah, so this is what this is a proof of these.
Okay.
For generic theories. Yeah, it is. I mean, it holds for these theories where we can check exactly, but here's an argument for why it's true generically. So we're gonna use the OPE to prove this. So the OPE to prove sum rules is a very common theme. You look at short time physics and this tells you the constraint on these integrals. So the first thing is that sigma is analytic in the upper half plane because it comes from a retarded correlation function of two currents. So there's no singularities in the upper half plane. Actually, there's no zeros as well. You can prove that. And now, so you want to integrate. You want to integrate this thing. Real part of sigma minus sigma of infinity. So you better have this to converge at large frequencies. You better have this to be integrable. And for that to be true, you need this dimension to be more than one. So if you continue to real frequencies, and if delta is not an integer, you still have that the real part behaves as 1 over omega to the delta. So if delta is greater than 1, this is integrable. And you can just prove the sum rule because the real part of sigma is even. Let me go here. You can just prove the sum rule by contour integration. So this is the complex plane of frequency. It's real, imaginary. You do this. There's nothing special in the upper half plane. This is 0. Hence, and decays fast enough on this half circle, hence the integral is 0. So that's, I don't know. And this holds for 1 over sigma 2. So what's interesting is that, so I gave a talk about this once and someone was asking like, oh, is this unitarity? Well, it turns out unitarity is not strong enough, at least as far as we know, to prove the sum rule because unitarity constrains. So okay, unitarity constrains the dimensions of the operators. So if you have a spin zero operator, so the scalar, the dimension has to be greater than d minus 2 over d, where d is a spacetime dimension. So this is 1/2 for d equal to 3. So if you put 1/2, then you don't get fast enough convergence to prove this. It's a 2. Thanks. And so the scalars can be dangerous. The other operators, which have spin, these have to be greater than L plus D minus 2, which is equal to L plus 1 for three spacetime dimensions. And so this corresponds to, if you have a current, L is equal to 2, that's 3 for a vector J, V mu. If L is equal to, no, that's 2. If L is equal to 3, to 2 for the stress tensor, this is 3. So all the higher spin operators are not dangerous for the sum rule, but the scalars potentially can be dangerous. And unitarity alone doesn't seem to prove the sum rule. If the sum rule was 2 delta here, that would work, but it's not 2 delta. So it's not clear to us why.
But I mean, this S duality is not really symmetry of the orthogonal, right? You go part of them, in terms of, it's not self duality, you go from one theory to another.
Yeah.
You're saying get the sum rule still works.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's not a self duality. I mean, the only non-trivial self-dual theory I know is this n equal 8 Spurrier-Yang Mills, where the R charge response is exactly constant. So that's what self-dual means. Sigma is equal to 1 over sigma, so sigma squared is equal to 1, so sigma is equal to a constant.
So this S-duality is just gauging the U1 symmetry, and then looking at the
connectivity of the dual symmetry. Yeah. Because then, as you gauge the symmetry, you have a new current, which is, so this is J dual, which is the curl of the gauge field introduced.
Do you gain anything if you look, there is a much there is that whole SL to Z action, not just in Z2 action, because again, action is almost copy and then gauge.
So I think it turns on in terms to these, that's what you mean, like?
Yes.
The T part, yeah, before gauging.
So does it mean that A sigma plus B over C sigma plus D also satisfies some rule?
Yes. So we haven't looked at this, but I'm guessing that that would also satisfy the sum rules. Because then you turn on a finite sigma x y, because it turns out in terms break commercial symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a Hall response essentially in a system. But that's also a response function which should satisfy the same properties. So we haven't looked at the T part. Actually, there's many things we haven't looked at yet, but this is very generic, so we expect this to be true. Mm-hmm. That's a good point. All right. Conclusions. We're doing good time. So we talked about dynamics of CFTs in 2 plus 1D. The main part was to constrain the short-time dynamics, what happens at very large frequencies, using these three-point functions, or OPs, which are a nice way of organizing these three-point functions. And that gives rise to the large frequency part of the connectivity. And we found that for the O2 model, there's a special term. It comes from a scalar, which is not present for Dirac fermions. And there's always a T over omega to the cube, which comes from a stress tensor, which is always there in any theory. And then we use this input data from the CFT analysis, so this dimension delta, to construct very simple holographic models which satisfy a bunch of physical properties, so they're not random functions, and then use to fit the data and to see what you get, and if it is very good, and you predict some real frequency response which can be proven or disproven in the future. But I should say that there's other methods to perform continuation, which are purely numeric, like maximum entropy methods. And I think it'd be nice to look at those with these constraints in mind. That's in progress, I think. So this is what I said with the fitting of the Monte Carlo data without any sort of ad hoc parameters, which we had to use before because we had the wrong theory in the bulk. All right, so more interesting, so outlooks. So I talked about this current, but you can talk about any primary two-point function. And the whole analysis of OPs, sum rules, and holography essentially follows true. And so you can look at these other correlation functions. So one that is interesting is, for example, this amplitude mode correlation function. And this is phi squared. Or stress tensor, anything you want. These are all observable. And other CFTs, so ON model with N equal to 3, for example, or deconfined critical points, which have a nice gauge structure at the critical point, and other dimensions too. And then another point is that can we go beyond the simple ansatz that we used, the simple parallel we postulated? So Rob has, told me that, okay, well, you can do better by, for example, I always lose the chalk. So you can do better by, for example, looking at a term that would be like phi. This is the same scalar we want to add. And then two well tensors. So these will be turned on at finite temperature. And so this will acquire essentially a VEV at finite temperature, which is what we want. And to solve that type of theory consistently, and then you will get different power law, different functional dependence at small u. And the question is, how does this compare with, for example, this very simple ansatz? We haven't done that yet. And you know, one thing that I'm puzzled by is that why isn't unitarity enough to prove the sum rule? Maybe it is. Maybe we're just missing something. But yeah, and this is all. Yeah. So thanks.
Is a C of JJT really abstract? It doesn't look like to me.
No, it's not. So Diego Hoffman and Maldacena essentially constrained that coefficient. So this has two coefficients. One of them is this gamma.
Yes.
And the gamma satisfies. So purely based on a CFT side, they have this argument to constrain gamma to be less than 1 over 12. And then if you look at the gravity side and look at the constraints of that coupling between two field strengths and the curvature tensor, you also find the same constraint. So it's suggested that this is actually true generically. So yeah,
what about the C, natural C, J, J, T, that is not arbitrary, right?
Rob, do you know if it's, I don't know, but.
I'm not sure what you mean by arbitrary. It's fixed by conformal invariance. They're two constants. And so,
but you allow a range of values for that other.
So they're both free parameters in principle.
Yeah, in principle.
Free, but I mean, so gamma is constrained to be in this very small window, and the question is the other OP coefficient also constrained?
But I think gamma, in some sense, is the ratio. Maybe I don't know how. I've forgotten where gamma fits into the sort of.
So maybe the ratio is constrained, but there's an overall factor that is not. Is that the?
That's what I'm thinking.
Okay, so maybe there's an overall factor that's not constrained. But there's two OP coefficients for the stress tensor, right?
Right, yeah, I mean, it's like the coefficient of the Maxwell term in principle is independent, and then this new term that you have.
Yeah, so okay, so that term is independent, yeah. Because the connectivity can be anything.
Yeah.
So maybe there's one that's not fixed and the other one is fixed, yeah.
Hmm.
And okay, so one other question is that, well, is this fixed, this JJO? So we haven't looked at that, but maybe it's not. I mean, it has to be fixed maybe to something.
Yeah, again, what do you mean by fixed?
I mean, I think...
Is there like a limit around...
Between the JJ normalization and the JJT. Just because I can integrate T over in that one plane, just... I mean, T is a generational translation, so
right.
Integrate T over a sphere and one of the operators, I get the translation of the operator.
Oh, they're going to be, okay. I guess.
I mean, that's because
he put
okay. One times I mean U.
Yeah.
And so, then.
So you want to, are you then saying you want to normalize the JJ correlator to some fixed coefficient? Or?
Well, I'm just saying there should be noise between the.
Yeah,
JJ normalization, JJT.
Yeah.
Which one? The Maxwell gives you JJ and JJ, and then piece of JJT.
But I mean, the question was, is this constrained to some finite range?
Oh, are the parameters in that?
The OP coefficients of JJO. That's the question. I think Max, did you, because you had a.
Yes.
But then we.
From this, suppose you were just on the CFT side, and suppose you were able to compute like a number of, I don't know, terms of the OP expansion. I mean, I guess these bootstrap methods are pretty good at that. So could you then use that to try to analytically continue to maybe not omega equals zero, but to some range of omega?
Yeah, so in principle, you can compute more of these leading terms to get sort of smaller omega physics. But eventually, this OP, the series diverges. It's a,
no,
but
yeah. I thought that OP is maybe like the reason that Bootstrap seems to work is that they don't seem to be also symbiotic series,
yeah.
But rather actually converge.
No, but they may have a finite range of convergence in this. It's pretty big.
I mean, what is used to conform a block, not just the power?
Mm-hmm.
That has sums, partially has sums, I think. I mean, the contribution of all the descendants, not just the primary.
So one question is, these coefficients in this asymptotic expansion, are they growing or getting smaller? Essentially, that's what we're asking. And so for free theories, these things grow like crazy, like vectorially, it turns out. But for strongly coupled theories, you don't expect that, but maybe they grow still. Yeah. I don't expect this OP convergence to reach to very small frequencies.
I guess you don't know the one-point functional descendants once you don't know temperature. So.
Yeah. But I mean, the Bootstrap does a great job at the t equals zero properties, like exponents and the OP coefficients. But
right.
I'm not sure how this translates into getting dynamics at small frequencies.
Maybe
but it's an open question.
Maybe the primary frequency, but you still need the expectation values, right? So maybe you could get those again from Monte Carlo, but maybe it will be very difficult to get the non-primary fields. Can you also say something about the long time field?
Yeah. So I have a slide just because I'm lazy. So it turns out that the long-time physics of conserved quantities, so this is the current, but this is the same, it holds out for the stress tensor, that these things don't decay exponentially at large times. That's what you expect at a finite temperature system. You have a finite correlation time, which is 1 over t, and things beyond that decay exponentially, right? But these are conserved quantities, and actually they decay in a slower fashion at very long times. So tau is time. And d here is the dimension of the space. So in two dimensions, it's 1 over t, but there's a log. In 3D, it's 1 over t to the 3 halves. And so if you do hydrodynamics and look at fluctuations, thermal fluctuations above hydrodynamics, so assume a finite conductivity, do fluctuations, you find that a contribution to that goes like this from this one loop, thermal loop, and this diverges at small frequencies. In other words, what we're saying is that the conductivity and diffusion constant are time dependent in 2 plus 1D. It's kind of like a peculiar situation. And it turns out people can probe this using molecular dynamic simulations of hard spheres. So, you know, like you do classical simulations and you crash these classical particles together and you look at long time correlations of the velocity-velocity distribution function and you find that there is this anomalous long time tail. And that's understood, right? I mean, we're not puzzled by this so much. But in holography, they're suppressed by 1 over n squared, where n is the gauge group rank. So Omid Saremi and Simon Caron-Riault did a 1 over n correction, which corresponds to a quantum gravity loop in a bulk, which actually is safe, it turns out, because you only care about the IR physics. And they found that they get these sort of singular terms at small frequencies. So in principle, it's kind of nice. You can get these hydrodynamic breakdown things from ADS-CFT, which you cannot get from the Boltzmann equation. At least no one has done it. So at very small frequencies, we expect this to be there. But Monte Carlo is blind to this. And the simple holographic tree level description also is blind to them. And so is 1 over n expansion of the ON model, because that's also suppressed by 1 over n. So yeah, these are these long time tails, 2 plus 1D.
How does this computation go? This one over n effect? How do they compute it? What do they do effect?
Yeah, so they compute one loop. So you have this Witten diagram of two currents. And in the bulk, I think they compute the graviton loop. One loop. And this graviton loop, you might be worried because it's UV unsafe, but this is an error property, so it turns out there. But they do Kalish because they do a real-time calculation. So it's kind of a messy paper. I mean, it's not trivial at all. But yeah, when the dust settles, yeah. Oh, dust run.
How do you rationalize your holographic ansatz? thinking about Hubbard model. That's the model that we started with. For example, you started with an ansatz which had gauge fields, then you added a 5 field.
I mean,
is there any physics behind this?
So the physics is like, okay, so give me your two-point function, you want to probe, say it's a current, J mu. So we know that's dual to a gauge field in the bulk. This is from symmetry consideration. So we have this field, you have a mu, which is what you're probing. And look, you look at a JJOP, so you compute that for a theory, and you find that there's a term that's equal to a scalar, and this has the lowest dimension. So you include this, so this is, on the CFT side, this is J mu, and you have the scalar, and this will become a scalar in the bulk. And now you fix the scale in the bulk to have asymptotic behavior to be delta equal to the dimension you find from the CFT analysis. So in this case, you fix the profile in the simple ansatz to be this power law. And this power comes from the CFT OPE data. And then you have some coefficient that you don't know, but in principle can be matched to the OPE of the JJL. So this is how you constrain. You constrain the field content and the asymptotic properties of those fields. But so there's input from the O2 model.
But if you didn't have the prediction of the simulation, the curve they're trying to fit, then alpha would be completely arbitrary. And so how would you use this model then?
Well, so I think in principle, if you compute, so you can match the JJ OOP coefficient with this alpha. Because turning on an alpha turns on a finite OP coefficient between two currents and a scalar. So I think you can predict what alpha is.
In principle, you could, but did you do that?
No, we could do that, but we sort of didn't. I don't know why. We have the numbers, I think. I think the problem is that for the ON model, computing 1/n corrections to this JJO is actually kind of hard. We only got the leading order 1/n. And so you don't trust the leading order 1/n calculations so much. So maybe that's why we didn't do it, because we didn't trust, with, in principle, if we have enough time to compute 1/n corrections, then you can ballpark alpha from the JJOP, JJO three-point function. But the delta, delta, that's known. I mean, 1/n just gives you dead on, yeah.
In a related question, can I ask Pedro's first question again? So you have Eric's data. Why don't we just fit that with A plus D over omega? Just a simple.
And do what with that?
Well, just say that's my fit for the curve.
So that's a fit on the real axis, on the imaginary axis.
Okay.
But that function on the real frequencies is sick, right? I mean, omega equal to zero diverges like a power law.
So it doesn't
capture the physics of the system.
Can Pedro sit down in his office and write down some other simple function that has that pole and a flat asymptotic? How hard is that to do? That has a nice analytic continuation. I mean, if I invent some other function, am I going to?
I think it's hard because you're trying to fit an irrational power law at large frequencies. I mean, if this was like 1/ω² or something, maybe that would be easier. But you know what? I haven't really done that, so maybe there's a simple answer to it. And then we can also use those functions to compare with and see if that's different or not. But I suspect it's not so easy. But maybe I should sit down. But as I said, you can do it sort of numerically in an unbiased fashion using these maximum entropy methods or other methods for firm continuation. But they're not controlled, so there's no physics input usually. But maybe constraining them from the OPE is also a better thing, which comes close to what you guys are saying, like let's try something else in holography.
You didn't talk about it, but don't you end up with the holographic result gives you some infinite collection of poles in the lower half plane?
Yeah.
Are those playing an important role in fitting together to get this, or is that just extraneous fluff?
No. I mean, so the function is fully determined by its poles, pretty much, and zeros. In that case, so if you're trying to do petty analysis where you approximate these functions by a finite number of quasi-normal modes, poles and zeros, then it's really hard to get a fit. This I tried. So that's one question generically is, are these excitation modes, these poles and zeros, physical? Does the O2 model have this infinite sequence of quasi-normal excitations? And that's a sharp question, which we don't have the answer to. But maybe this is one step towards answering that. I think certain poles are definitely going to be there, like the one on the imaginary axis, which gives you like this small peak, small frequencies. But the other ones, yeah. So I think it's not so simple to have functions that respect all the physical properties, and you can write down with a pencil. That's my guess.
But do you think an infinite set of poles is required, or?
Well, no, I don't know, right? No one knows.
Okay.
If I knew, I'd have a job or something. No, because that's a hard question. You're asking about the excitation spectrum of a strongly coupled CFT at small n, which is not known.
Is there a way in the O2 model you could access at least the first quasi-normal mode?
Yeah, we found that with one over an expansion.
But, yeah. Oh, you did?
Yeah. That's what started this whole business, essentially.
Okay.
So when you look at the 1 over n expansion, this Lorentzian is exactly a single pole. That's what a Lorentzian is.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And so we found that if you do 1 over n, you find exactly a single pole in the imaginary axis. So this finite lived excitation. But then you can't get the other ones, at least easily, if they are there. But we think they're there. So that's our claim. Max.
So that pole is particle or vortex?
It's particle because it's a pole. If it was a zero, so the pole structure we predict for the O2 model is there's a pole here, and there's an infinite sequence of poles that extends like this, and there are zeros in between. The zeros have to be there essentially because you want to match the constant at large frequencies. You have to have the same number of zeros and poles pretty much. There's only one difference is that this guy appears alone. There's no partner zero to that. But that's the quasi-normal mode structure of this theory.
The vortices are not that far from the, in terms of the kind of linear area, the vortices, they also play. I mean, if I identify the zeros with the vortices,
exactly.
they play some role.
They play some role, yeah. At least in holography. It's not clear if you look at the O2 model, the actual answer, what is the excitation spectrum? But, yeah. So this is our claim, is that it will be close to that. But we know that there's a, you know, in a real CFT at small n, there's a branch cut. There's a log at small frequencies. You know, so that's one thing that you have to add on this structure.
I see, ADS CFT misses.
The tree level misses, but one of our incorrections in a bulk, which correspond to static fluctuations on the boundary, get that. But it's hard to get a full function using one loop correction in a bulk. But no, IDSCFT does not miss that. That's a nice part about IDSCFT.
So what's the physics of a branch cut? Is there some simple physics?
Well, so simple physics. I don't have a simple heuristic answer why these long time tails exist. I mean,
is that branch cut? That's
a long time tail, yeah. Because power laws correspond to branch cuts, right? If you only had poles and zeros, exponential decay at large times, right? And the time would be dictated by the pole which is closest to the imaginary axis. But if you have a branch cut, you get a power law in a Fourier transform. So that's exactly the what I talked about, but okay.
So the zeros and poles are modes of the gauge boson in the bulk.
What is the?
Should I think about these poles and zeros as some sort of quasi-normal modes of the gauge boson in the bulk?
Yes, I mean so in the bulk, these are sort of exactly the quasi-normal modes of the black hole, which are modes of the photon.
For the photon, not the black.
So in ADS, the black hole is like a drum in a box, so it has a finite number of modes.
I mean, this brings together the graviton and the photon.
Yeah, I mean, they come from interplay between the graviton and the photon.
But and ignore the interplay of the scalar field, whatever.
No, no, so with a scalar field, you change where they are, but you still get the same...
Yeah, but the scalar field is not contributing to their fluctuation.
When you say there's an interplay, it's the gauge field on a fixed background. I mean, these quasi-normal modes.
Yeah, it's a fixed background.
Yeah, so it's a fixed gravitational background. You can stick a fixed scalar background as well, and he's calculating the modes of the gauge field.
But you can think of this as like... small vibrations of this horizon.
So coming to the original boson of the Hubbard model, they support vertices and anti-vertices. Is there any image of that to these modes that you are talking about? Because the physical bosons of the Hubbard model, suppose the superfluid condensates. When superfluid destroys, you can imagine it happening through proliferation of vertices and anti-vertices.
Right.
So the poles and the zeros that you are talking about, are they images of that or something different?
Yeah, so the poles you can see as the excitations of the particles, and the zeros as the excitations of the vortex field.
I see. So there is a physical connection between the vertices of the superfluid and these objects deep in the ADS space.
Well, using this particle vortex duality, there's a correspondence in the connectivity. So these zeros are not in physical modes, they're actually physical modes of the dual theory of the vortex description of the same CFT.
I see.
Yeah. But it's really the same CFT, you're describing different languages.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should probably go for lunch.
Just stop, but thank you.